From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, a new study shows Milwaukee nonprofits are beginning to thrive once again. Then Joe Bartolotta shares one of the reasons his restaurant business has been a success for 20 years.
I think where a lot of restaurants fail to succeed is that, you know, they don't touch their guests on an emotional level and create a reason for that guest to want to come back.
Later, a historian tells the story of the Civil War in 50 objects.
And it was really tough. It was like Sophie's Choice times 10, picking the objects to represent the whole march from slavery to freedom.
And Sean Roche explains why he chose music.
You could say that's the one thing I stuck to, and I never gave up. I've tried a lot of things like, you know, skateboarding or school, but nothing really stuck, but music always has.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. It was described as a perfect storm, the interaction between the Great Recession and nonprofit organizations. Giving was down to nonprofits at exactly the time when many of their services were needed the most. The economic recovery has been slow in coming, but new research shows that Milwaukee-area nonprofits are in a much stronger position than they were just a couple of years ago. The research was undertaken by the newspaper Biz Times in collaboration with a journalism class at UW-Milwaukee. Executive editor Steve Jagler spoke with Mitch Tyke last month when the study was released, along with journalism students James Gutierrez and Samantha Nash. Jagler says things seem pretty good now for many nonprofits.
I think the people within the nonprofit industry were mostly surprised at the number of nonprofits, 62%, that say they have recovered from the Great Recession. We really didn't know what to expect going into this. So the fact that so many say they've recovered and so many expect to have more donations in 2013 than they did in 2012, I think those numbers were surprising.
Well, and it seemed like the numbers were, if not overwhelming, certainly convincing that you were actually depicting a trend. It was not ambiguous.
I'd say that's the case.
How many nonprofits did you survey for this?
We had responses from 79 out of a database of 120 or so. 79 nonprofit executives responded.
And this is obviously not every single nonprofit group in the Milwaukee area, but were you pretty satisfied that the research yielded a representative cross-section of the sector?
Yeah, I think so. We had groups from a lot of different organizations all across the board. And just today, actually, I was reading up a little bit more. I guess as far as the top 30 cities nationwide, Milwaukee was actually ranked top of the list for median charitable donations, which is pretty interesting, and I thought that really validated our research even that much more, which is really cool to see that.
What do we know about how the economy affects nonprofits versus other sectors of the community?
Well, I think with this recession recovery, we've seen a lot of stagnation in terms of job growth. But I think seeing the growth that's happened in the nonprofit industry really gives a little bit more indication of how businesses are doing, because a lot of nonprofits get their biggest contributions from businesses. So even though businesses are running a little bit leaner and not hiring as many people, they're still making more charitable donations than they were maybe 3 years ago.
I think, Mitch, this survey illustrated how the nonprofit sector was affected in a similar way that the for-profit sector was. Most of the nonprofits we talked to, they had to do more with less because there was less available. So they had to collaborate. The recurring phrase we kept hearing is, we have to do more with less. And that certainly has been true in the private sector.
Well, and along the lines of collaboration, that seemed to be one of the salient points, that collaboration started when the recession was at its worst. But it sounds like they are persisting even today, that collaboration goes on even as these nonprofit groups have recovered. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say so. And I'd say it was a matter of necessity and survival for the nonprofits that made it through those darker, leaner times. Collaboration was a matter of survival.
The collaborative nature of everything was really interesting. Especially the people that we talked to, they all knew they needed to buy in. But one of the numbers that I saw that kind of jumped out at me, because of things, when we were going over questions, Samantha led this group discussion about what questions were we interested in, and the idea of volunteering came up. And I think that we have these numbers that show that we're doing great as far as raising money. They're expecting more money. But at the same time, the collaboration between the community and the nonprofits is something that I think we can still strive for, because over 80% in the survey said that they needed more volunteers. So as much as the business community is doing to raise money, I think it's something that the communities in general, just with manpower, can get out there and support these nonprofits just as much.
Steve, I know your newspaper in the past has reported on, all of us did this when the recession was at its worst, this perfect storm, the idea that nonprofits were struggling at a time when their services were needed more than ever. Did the results of this indicate to you that those nonprofits are pulling out of that perfect storm? Are they now able to start serving more people than they were?
It's a moving target, to be sure. They do expect increased donations in 2013, more than they received in 2012. But I don't think any of them are spinning cartwheels in the streets about where they're at. And the recession certainly created a greater need for core services, human services, food, health care, as benefits. People lost their benefits. And nonprofits across the board were affected by it, because what happened then is the donors that were still giving recognized that the core services were what was needed. That put greater pressure on the nonprofits for the arts, for instance. They became less of a priority in the recession, and that came back to us in the survey.
Samantha and James, what were the specific kinds of questions that you asked when you reached out to these nonprofits?
We really tried to focus, first of all, on their own self-assessment, how they felt that they were doing and how they felt they had recovered. And then we tried to follow it up with questions about their staffing, about what kinds of resources they needed, whether they needed additional space, additional people. And one of the bigger ones was whether or not they needed more people or better people on their board of trustees to get things motivated and get things happening within their organization.
Well, and what did you hear along those lines?
73% said that they need more effective board members. So it's definitely a concern among nonprofits, I think, getting people at the top out there and fundraising, making connections and all of that.
James, were there other questions that you think drove at this question in a way that this issue in a way that maybe hadn't been asked so much?
I mean, I think it was pretty comprehensive. And we got a lot of people on the phone as well, and we got to talk to them. Another thing that we did talk about, though, was just the, the changing landscape that puts people in touch with nonprofits. Over 70% of them stated that they needed more effective marketing or social media plans or identities, trying to get that presence out there. You know, we're all plugged in somehow. I mean, if people are listening to this, you're plugged in somehow. So I think that's just something that, going forward, they would like to do better, just getting connected to people.
Steve Jagler, did you go back and speak with the nonprofit leaders after the results of the survey became known?
Yes, we surveyed the individual nonprofits, and then the students went back and interviewed some people who are involved in the nonprofit industry, people at the Donors Forum, Greater Milwaukee Foundation, United Way, and so forth, to get their interpretation of the results, since they are living it day to day and seeing it. They're on the front lines of it. It was interesting to get their reaction to the numbers that our survey showed.
Well, was it an eye opener to those people who are experts in the field? Did they realize that these trends were the case?
I think there was a lot of surprise, actually, that things were shaping up to be so positive. I think with a lot of the news, especially related to the rate of unemployment in the country, I think there's a sense that things are still not so good. And so our survey results really kind of showed that, you know, things are turning around in a lot of ways. I think it was kind of a surprise.
Was it a surprise to you?
Yeah, I'd say the numbers were more optimistic than what I would have expected them to be. I think it speaks to just how resourceful the nonprofits in the Milwaukee area had to be and have to be and will be.
Can you talk about how this collaboration came together? How did BizTimes happen to this project with journalism students?
Good question. The stars just all lined up in a row for this situation. I was asked for the first time to teach this advanced course at UWM, my alma mater. So I was happy to give it a go and see where it took us. And I think the students and I literally learned as we went along. But we had this database of the BizTimes nonprofit directory with 120 nonprofits in it. And I threw it to the students, you know, as a final project for the class, what could we do with this? And it was one of the students actually that came up with the grand idea of, well, let's ask them if they rebounded from the recession. And from there, the students divided up the nonprofits by the letters in the alphabet, and they appointed a captain who was Samantha to be kind of the lead student on the project. And she was kind of the traffic cop. And then they each reached out to their designated or nonprofits within the survey findings. And so they each needed to rely upon the other. It was a great teamwork exercise. But I'd rather have them talk about what they learned from the whole process. So, well, Sam, what did you get out of it?
I think it was a really unique opportunity. It was unlike anything else that I've done in school so far, in that it involved such a large scale of collaboration with area organizations as well as my classmates. One of the things that was really neat about this class is that we had the opportunity to interview a lot of people from area businesses in addition to all of these nonprofits. So when it came time to do these interviews and come up with questions, we already had a really good understanding of some of the business trends, particularly that you know, nonprofits kind of rely on businesses and that there's a very symbiotic relationship between them. So, I think it was unique and very awesome to take part in.
How did the collaboration play out as far as your journalism experience goes?
Well, I've had a couple really good experiences so far with the whole journalism field and pretty much getting experiences under my belt. But I think to come together with a bunch of people that are kind of just going at it, first timers, kind of just trying to get an understanding of things and working together, and the spirit of collaboration was really, really great. I think doing it at a school like UWM, where it's more like a commuter school, so there's a naturally like this kind of a distance if you want to keep your distance from other students in the class. It was really, really fun to come together in that way.
Well, James, Steve, Sam, thank you so much, and congratulations on putting this whole survey together.
Thanks for having us. Thank you very much.
Steve Jagler is the executive editor at the newspaper Biz Times. James Gutierrez and Samantha Nash are journalism students at UW-Milwaukee, and they're members of the class that collaborated with Biz Times on new research about the economic health of Milwaukee area nonprofits. There is a link to the study from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Ristorante Bartolotta is celebrating 20 years in 2013. We'll talk with the co-owner Joe Bartolotta next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The Bartolotta Restaurants owns and operates many diverse eateries in southeastern Wisconsin, including Lake Park Bistro, Harbor House, Bacchus, North Point, and Rumpus Room. 2013 marks the 20th anniversary of Ristorante Bartolotta, the first of these restaurants. Co-owner Joe Bartolotta went to New York out of high school to learn the restaurant business from the ground up, and he returned to Milwaukee and founded the Bartolotta Restaurants with his brother Paul, who's now a chef in Las Vegas. The business has flourished over these past 20 years, employing more than 1,000 people, and it shows no signs of slowing down. But during the past 10 years, Bartolotta was having life-threatening medical issues due to complications from diabetes. Thanks to his brother-in-law's organ donation, however, he had a kidney transplant in February and quite literally has a new lease on life. He joined me in the studio last month to talk about both his health and the past 20 years in the restaurant business, and he began by explaining the secret to his success.
I'd like to think that a lot of it has to do with our culture and who we are and how we treat our people. You know, there's a lot of great restaurants that serve great food. There's a lot of cool-looking places. There's a lot of good service. But I think where a lot of restaurants fail to succeed is that, you know, they don't touch their guests on an emotional level and create a reason for that guest to want to come back. You know, we've all been in restaurants where we've eaten a meal and it's been a really good experience. But for some reason, we've never gone back. So for whatever reason, that restaurant failed to touch you enough or to create that emotional connection enough to want you to come back. And so we've been very successful. And it's primarily through our people and how we treat our people. You know, when you hire a bunch of really sparkly, happy, well-adjusted, team-oriented people and put them together in a business and they're all moving in the same direction at the same time, you become incredibly powerful. And that's really the secret to our success. We really treat our employees very well.
Do you also give them room to experiment and try things that may or may not have worked?
You know, I think we have a very collaborative environment as a company. I love to get a lot of information from a lot of people before we make decisions on how to do something. And I think, you know, the best way to function is to get consensus. Because the reality is, I'm not in the restaurants every night. My servers are. They know exactly what the customers are saying. They know exactly what's right and wrong. And so I'm a bad business person if I don't listen to what my employees, my line employees, tell me what's going on in our restaurants. So, yeah, I think we're very collaborative. And we also have to function with some form of structure. I think that's another area where other restaurants perhaps struggle a little bit because it's a very complex business. It's not just serving great food. There's a whole business side of it. And the way we view it is our business has to be sort of a yin and a yang. There has to be the emotional and the creative and the artistic side of our business. But there also has to be the true business side of our business where you watch your food costs, you watch your labor costs, you watch your expenses. Because at the end of the day, if you just deliver a great experience but don't care about the cost, you'll end up with no money at the end of the day. Conversely, if you end up, you know, too focused on the bottom line, then you cut away and chip away at the guest experience. And I think that's a problem as well. So there's this constant battle that we have. We always do this gut check. Is this the best thing for our guests and is the best thing for our company?
What do you think have been some of your biggest successes in these last 20 years?
Well, this may sound a little hokey, but some of our biggest successes, we had a Christmas party last year. We went to Dave & Buster's and we filled it up. There were about over 1,000 people there. And one of the cool things was I was watching families walk around, a husband and a wife, with two or three little kids following behind them. And again, this is going to sound hokey, but it's truly what I believe is that part of my responsibility is to not only enhance my life and my family's life, but to enhance the people around us and bring everybody's standard of living up a little bit. So we have over 1,000 employees. So I take that very, very seriously. So the fact is, 20 years ago, did I ever think I'd have 1,000 employees? You know, we have we sort of track this very odd statistic, but we have produced through our company at last count about 61 weddings and marriages, which have resulted in families and kids and stuff. And a lot of our senior managers, you know, met their significant other while working in the restaurant. And, you know, people fall in love working in restaurants. And
so it's really a big family in a lot of ways.
It so is.
And also a business.
It so is, you know. And there's been a little shift lately in the last couple of years. We've had to run our business a little bit more like a business because the competitive pressures and the pressure of you know, the cost of goods and the raw material costs are going up. So it's creating a lot of pressure on our margin that we have. And so, you know, we have to make these very tough choices sometimes that typically 5 or 6 years ago we wouldn't have had to make.
Such as?
That's a good question. You know, our staffing levels sometimes, you know, we always had what we called a very strong bench. You know, we kept a lot of extra people on because we were in a growth mode and we always wanted to have the opportunity. So when we opened a restaurant, we didn't have to go to the outside. We would always pull people into from our company. We just opened 2 Joy Girards last year, and that's 2 very large restaurants. We promoted internally 16 people. So that sort of cleared out our bench, so to speak, and it gave a lot of opportunity for people. We promoted 16 people, and then underneath them, we promoted 16 people, you know, to fill those positions that were vacated. So it's a good thing to grow. But, you know, we've had to recognize that there are costs associated with carrying a strong bench. And so we've had to reduce the strength of our bench just a little bit. You know, looking at everything that we look at in our company, we still try to buy the best and still try to afford the best. But now we're being much more aggressive with our vendors and we're looking for better deals out there. We're shopping 3 or 4 vendors against each other to find the best possible price for something. And before, we just would buy it because we wanted it. So little tiny things that all add up to big things.
Well, and one of the big things that's been happening, too, is your own health and the fact that you just recently underwent a kidney transplant. How has that and sort of the concerns for your health over the years affected how you've done business? And is it changing forward now that you're healthy again?
Yeah, I mean, I've had diabetes for 32 years. And as part of the baggage that goes with diabetes is there's going to be complications that come from it. It's a horrible disease, but because it has very significant end stage complications. But pretty much during the run of diabetes, you feel pretty normal, you know. So it's a very slow creep, debilitating disease. And one of the complications that come from diabetes, it affects your small blood vessels, the eyes, you know, the kidneys, the extremities, fingers, toes. And so, you know, I started experiencing some kidney issues about 10 years ago. So, you know, there was plenty of time in the pipeline to plan for this and to prepare for it. And knowing you have a chronic illness, I've never let it slow me down. I've never really let it influence how I run my life. I always have a very optimistic outlook on things. But, you know, when it got to about 2.5 years ago, when the function of the kidney was getting down to 15%, you know, I started to have to think about, okay, I'm going to need either dialysis or I'm going to need a transplant. Dialysis for me was not an option. I could not be strapped up to a machine for 4 hours a day, three times a week. It just would have been a horrible life for me. And the prognosis for me on dialysis would not have been a really long one. So we decided to go after the transplant, and I was incredibly fortunate and lucky to have a brother-in-law, my wife's brother, get tested. He put his hand up right away and said, I'll be tested. And, you know, he's a 31-year-old guy, super healthy, you know, runs 5 miles a day, just a great outlook on life. We have a lot of similarities personality-wise. And he stepped up and he said, you know, I'll get tested, Joe. And he never wavered. In 2.5 years, he was always rock solid. So it was a scheduled procedure, and we had the procedure done on February 18th, so I'm about 15 weeks out. And my life changed overnight. It was like my function was down to 12%. And, you know, less than 15 minutes after the surgery, my function shot up to about 98% kidney function.
Wow.
It is a miracle. It really is. Jamie's function, my brother-in-law's function, went from 100% down to about 46%. The kidneys are incredibly resilient. So within about a three-month period, his remaining kidney will realize that he's under capacity and will start to grow. And it'll grow anywhere from 30 to 40% over the next 2 to 3 months. And he'll be right back up to 98%. So it's an amazing organ. We have such excess capacity with kidneys. You know, kidney donors tend to live longer than most people because in order to even qualify to be a donor, you have to be very healthy. And those people have healthy lifestyles already. So just innately, those people are going to live longer.
Well, Joe Bartolotta, it has been great talking with you. I'm so glad to see you in good health and fine fettle, and that the company is as well. And I look forward to many more years of having conversations with you.
Thanks, Bonnie. I appreciate it.
Joe Bartolotta is the co-owner of Bartolotta Restaurants, including Lake Park Bistro, Bacchus, North Point, and the company's first restaurant, Ristorante Bartolotta. There's more information about the business and about kidney donation at wuwm.com/legeffect. Our interview with Joe Bartolotta first aired last month. Coming up after a break, the history of the Civil War told through 50 objects. We'll hear about some of them when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. The sesquicentennial of the Civil War continues this year. The first 3 days of this month mark the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. Although the story of the Civil War is often told from the perspective of battles, regiments, and victories and losses, millions of artifacts bring the history of this crucial American event alive today. One of the most expansive collections of such artifacts resides at the New York Historical Society, which recently challenged historian and author Howard Holzer to choose just a few that would tell the story of the war between the states. The result is his new book, The Civil War in 50 Objects, and Holzer explains to Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce how he rose to the challenge.
Well, it wasn't easy, but the idea here is to tell a broad story through sometimes small, intimate, or grand pieces that people saved for posterity. The British Museum did this in the History of the World in 100 Objects, and so it's always a challenge. The Historical Society has 1 million objects, large and small, relating to the Civil War era. So they put out about 100 for me to choose from, and it was really tough. It was like Sophie's Choice times 10, picking the objects to represent the whole march from slavery to freedom, and trying to represent every kind of artistic and documentary medium that is represented in the collection.
Well, let's start with what you begin the book with, which is this artifact, these shackles that held a small child slave.
It's pretty brutal, and they're very small. They're pretty much life-size in this normal-sized volume. And it's probably maybe the most harrowing thing in the whole book. The idea that a tiny child would be kept at bay, and the reason, I think, that many of these, they were also called bilboes, the reason that children were shackled this way and then attached to other things is because on the journey to slavery from Africa, some mothers, desperate and fearful, would try in the middle of the night to throw their little ones overboard, really to sacrifice them so they wouldn't have to spend a life or the next generation spend their life in slavery. So it's so horrible, it's unspeakable, and these little shackles are the way that you can keep the mothers from sacrificing the children.
How did you balance bringing in aspects of slavery as the cause of the Civil War with some of the alternative explanations for the conflict that we hear tossed around a lot these days, states' rights and things like
that? Well, I do have a bow to states' rights in that the mayor of New York was pretty much a secessionist himself. He wanted to maintain profitable trade with southern states. So he had the ultimate states' rights idea, which was to make a trade alliance with Louisiana, which was one of the first states to secede, and then to become an independent city-state. In other words, he wanted New York City to secede. Well, Abraham Lincoln made sure that didn't happen. So that's my one recognition that there were other factors at work, and some of them were commercial. But I'm of the view, and I think most historians are of the view, that there was only one cause of the Civil War. Certainly what, I mean, you can say secession caused the Civil War. The firing on Fort Sumter caused the Civil War, but nothing caused secession except slavery. And you can read that in all of the secession ordinances that were drafted by the states when they seceded and by the Confederate Constitution, which enshrined slavery as a virtue. I don't want to shrink from that as the cause of the war, and I don't think the book does.
Tell me about the challenge of trying to include objects that even in their own times had multiple interpretations and then bringing them up to date in terms of how we view them today. I'm thinking specifically of this painting of slave life in the South.
Oh, yes, the Eastman Johnson painting. And you're absolutely right. No one was ever sure what Eastman Johnson meant by this painting called Negro Life at the South. What is it supposed to show? It shows a rather contented group of people living in ramshackle circumstances and a mistress, a white mistress, emerging into the scene. The young black man plays a banjo. A couple is sort of spooning at the left of the scene, people looking out an upstairs window. I think it's supposed to show that life goes on for slaves, but Eastman Johnson so quickly became a sort of an abolitionist artist that I think you can easily interpret that he meant to say that the white woman at the right who is looking at this realizes she's looking at a vanishing world, a world that'll soon come collapsing down. But that's what makes art so interesting. You can read it so many different ways. The important thing is a really good painting also.
Indeed, you include several artistic representations. You include sculptures, political cartoons that were published, although you mentioned in certain cases they weren't published or distributed as widely during the war as they would perhaps after. Do we often give enough credit to the fact that there was an ongoing public dialogue that was being reflected in the arts at that time?
You know, that's a beautiful way of putting it. I've written about this for 40 years, and I will immediately steal your phrase and use it as my own. No, I'll give you credit. An ongoing public dialogue through art is absolutely true. It was not just editorials. It was not just the political. It was a battle of art. And the Confederates might have been equal players in that battle, but for the simple fact that they ran out of three things that were really important to wage that fight. One of them is artists, because there was universal conscription and only 80-year-old or 10-year-old artists would have been safe. The second is paper. They had huge paper shortages, so much so that, as this book shows, some newspapers had to be printed on wallpaper. And third, they ran out of ink. They just didn't have the supplies to compete. So the dialogue really narrowed down to that between Democrats and Republicans in the North, pro-Lincoln and anti-Lincoln forces in the Union states. But meanwhile, there was a generation of soldier artists and pictorial weekly artists who witnessed extraordinary things that tell huge stories in very small and intimate ways. And I think there's one example in the book. It's a Frank Leslie's artist sketching a group of African Americans wandering into a Union camp. You almost can't even tell what it is. It just looks like a group of silhouettes, some on horseback, some walking, with soldiers looking on, some not even looking on. Well, why is it important? Because it's an example of enslaved people abandoning their plantation because, A, they knew the Emancipation Proclamation legally set them free if they could get away from their white masters, and, B, they had heard that Ulysses S. Grant's army was within a few miles. Now was their chance. They took their life in their hands. They fled. They walked into Union lines where they were embraced and recognized as free, no doubt put to work, but better than being enslaved. But the biggest story of all is who these slaves were. They were owned by Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. And if this artist had not been on the scene to witness this huge ultimate rebuke of slavery, an institution that Jefferson Davis thought was divinely ordained, then we never would have had this record. So it's a tiny, almost unrecognizable sketch that tells a huge story.
Some of these objects have been written about so many times, you know, the copies of the Emancipation Proclamation, yet you managed to bring in not only a backstory to some of these documents, but you also find these other objects that could so easily be overlooked.
I tried. I was mesmerized by this sort of unattractive series of postcards. I guess they're postcard size, almost like index cards that had a series of buttons, brass buttons on them. And what they represent are soldiers, souvenir hunters, slash scavengers who plucked buttons from the corpses of dead soldiers, or worse, went to Confederate or Union prison camps and traded liquor or extra food or tobacco for buttons. And they wanted to collect buttons. They had some intrinsic metallic value. And they were also like, they were like scalps. They were like trophies of war. So those are tiny, intimate items that tell sort of a scary backstory of the war. And then there were some things that were completely unknown to me. I've been writing about Lincoln for 40 years, and I never knew that Abraham Lincoln had, I knew of one example, but I never knew that the Historical Society had an earlier example of Lincoln going up to the War Department, where he went almost every night to get war news because the White House didn't have a telegraph. And there, taking a piece of War Department letterhead and jotting down electoral votes that he thought would lean to him or lean to his opponent in the 1864 presidential race, he was so nervous about finding a path to victory in that hotly disputed campaign that he almost did what Tim Russert did in 2000, putting together those charts with different electoral vote paths to the electoral majority. So here he was waiting for news of life and death from the battlefield, but also calculating his political life or death in the White House.
Which ultimately would have had an impact on the soldiers on the field.
And on emancipation, on everything.
Tell me about some of the objects you put together that kind of told the story of the soldiers from both sides and what their experiences were. In some of these objects, you really see that, particularly the letters, you see that the soldiers themselves are trying to make sense of the experiences that they're having.
Yeah, and you see things that you didn't expect. You see in Union soldiers' diaries, you know, racism, how they refer to the people of color that they encounter along the way. You see a desperation to keep life sort of normal. So Confederate prisoners do drawings of things like lice infestation and the infirmary, or they create their own newspaper written meticulously in almost calligraphic penmanship so that they could have something to read to pass around. They couldn't print it, so they made one copy and passed it around. You see a drum that a drummer boy used in battle with two bullet holes in it. And you see a flamboyant Zouave uniform, baggy red trousers, a fez, epaulettes, which were worn once upon a time by soldiers who were considered the toughest men in the army, almost like special forces. But they dressed in such a flamboyant way that they were huge targets. So, you know, amazing things, and amazing for their state of preservation as well.
What was perhaps one of the more surprising items that you came across as you went through the New York Historical Society's collection to compile this book?
The most surprising to me, without a doubt, was a copy of the Terms of Surrender between Lee and Grant at Appomattox. Ulysses S. Grant, when he went to Washington to assume the command of all the Union armies, went to a stationery store and was sort of entranced by this early carbon paper kind of a thing, thin, filmy, waxy paper that you could use to make copies. And when he was ready to ask Colonel Eli Parker to write down the surrender terms as he dictated them, he had Parker use this carbon paper and make four or five simultaneous copies. Then when he was done, he gave one to Lee, one to himself, one to somebody else to read, make changes, and then they did the final. When it was all over, Grant gave one copy to Colonel Eli Parker. Colonel Eli Parker was a Seminole Indian, and he stood out in this sea of very white faces. And when General Lee left the surrender room, he shook hands with all of Lee's staff, and when he came to Parker, he stopped sort of short, looking into this dark-skinned face. And then I guess he realized he wasn't black, that would have been too much for him, that he was a Native American. And he looked at him and said, "Well, at least there's one real American in this room." And Eli Parker looked right back at General Lee and said, "General Lee, today we're all Americans." So here is a memento of the final moments of the Civil War and a final confrontation where an American Indian had to be the one to say that unity meant racial unity as well.
Why use objects to tell the story of the Civil War instead of just using any one of the stories you present in this book to illustrate what the Civil War was about?
You know, there are so many ways into the story. I think this combines a kind of, darting in and out of different story approach. But it also is almost a tactile way of looking at the war. You can feel and touch objects. You can't really, but you can come so close with this wonderful color reproductions of these items that stand out so beautifully. And appreciate the artistic involvement, the preservation, the respect that people had over time, the commitment to keeping diaries, and the political determination to sign a 25-foot-long petition to end slavery in America, saving the flag that was waved from Broadway when the first New York regiments went off to war. There's a lot of emotion involved in objects, and I think the emotion comes through to the reader. It's not just about military strategy. It's not just about politics. It's about passion. And the passion is what I was hoping to recreate through this kind of visceral path to the history of the war.
Well, Harold Holzer, thank you so much for sharing the Civil War in 50 Objects with us.
Thank you for asking me.
Harold Holzer is the author of The Civil War in 50 Objects in partnership with the New York Historical Society, the oldest museum in New York City. He first spoke with Stephanie Lecce in May. Holzer has written and edited more than 40 books on Lincoln and the Civil War era and has won the National Humanities Medal. We'll take one last break, and then another in a series of Lake Effect interns has an album launch. We'll get a preview of that CD, Twin Brother, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's not an official requirement of Lake Effect interns that they be aspiring musicians, but it doesn't hurt, and it just so often turns out that way. Following in the wake of such luminaries as Trapper Shep and Paul Schwarzkopf, Sean Rosch and his band Twin Brother launched their new self-titled CD at Club Garibaldi in May. The song we're hearing is called Overwhelming. It's from the CD. Rosch tries not to attach a particular label to the music, but if nothing else, it can certainly be termed indie rock. Rosch told Lake Effect's Dan Harmon in May about his own musical journey.
I've just been playing music and have been into music generally since I was a little boy. So I was always interested in learning how to play music any way I could. When I was young, it was mainly just singing. I sang over, you know, like Boys to Men cassette tapes, Michael Jackson and all that kind of neat stuff when I was a little kid, you know. But that turned into me trying to, you know, get a guitar and learn how to play. It was very frustrating for a while, as is any instrument and, you know, learning how to play it. But I guess you could say that's the one thing I stuck to and I never gave up. I've tried a lot of things like, you know, skateboarding or school. but nothing really stuck, but music always has. And so I'm one to just go with what sticks and what's organic to my nature. So
why didn't you stick with the pop genre?
With the pop genre?
Yeah, I'm singing Michael Jackson and whatnot from your childhood.
I don't know. I would have to say life jaded me a little bit, and life isn't pop music. So, again, that's not really organic or natural to me, I guess.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what style would you say that you've developed into, or singer-songwriter sound, if you will?
The track that I'm going to play is off our new record, off Twin Brothers' new record, and it's played acoustically on the album. It's a very intimate song, I would say, and it's just with a Spanish guitar and vocals. It's kind of folk-driven, I think. But yeah, and as well as the rest of the record, I think is kind of folky. Indie folk, as the cool kids say.
As the hipsters say.
Yeah.
Indie folk. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think about all the... I mean, do you have to label it? Does it even mean anything? I mean...
I don't like labeling at all. I think the second you put a label on it and people hear that label before they get a chance to hear you, they've already judged you in some shape or form. So I hate the labeling, but I suppose it's somewhat necessary because audibly, how can you get across an idea without putting a label on it unless you're, you know, just playing it live? So
I've asked this to a few musicians before about labeling. I'm wondering, because at some point you're going to be forced to label yourself, right? I mean,
sure.
Not just me asking you, but for example, your album, your release, it's got to be labeled somehow and put somewhere. So
yeah.
How do you go about that? I mean, because, you know, I mean, you can get yourself into this weird corner, I think, when you're creating music or composing music. Do you feel like you have to create for that style, that label?
No, I try and definitely not do that. I try and just create to what I enjoy playing, I guess, and what's natural to me and what feels good to play and sounds good to my ear. But you're right, you do have to label that at some point. And a perfect example of that is just uploading it to, you know, Bandcamp or whatever, and they require you to put a tag on it. You know, well, what do you got to tag this as? Alternative, indie rock, indie folk, a cappella? You know, so you got to pick something, because if you don't, then people aren't going to find your stuff because they're typing in the search box, you know, what they want to hear or whatever. So I always just go with folk or indie, and but I don't really know what to label it as.
Okay.
So.
Well,
I don't know if that's accurate.
Tell us about the song you're going to perform.
That song is kind of I would say I wrote it about my general life in music in a 3-second song. It's just about being a local musician that, I guess, in the whole spectrum of the world and entertainment, really no one knows who you are or really cares. And that's just kind of what it's about. But that doesn't mean that there's no passion or emotion or something important, you know, that I have to say. So I guess it's generally about that. And the main line in that song, up on stage with a mask and no name. It's kind of the big line in that song that really describes it. So,
and you're not wearing a mask here, though?
No.
Okay. Well, let's give it a listen.
Or I could be.
All right. Well, here we go.
See the difference. Courage makes up on stage with a mask and no name. You can step on me, but I won't break. And if I bend, you'll see what I can take. I figure the line was made for us. The shadow inside was made out of lust. You see it in
Tell us about the rest of your group. Do you have a band name, or is it just you? Who's your name?
No. Well, we used to be called Jack Rosh, and I play with the drummer as a two-piece for years. But this is kind of a starting over stage for us. The new band name is Twin Brother. And that came up from playing with the drummer for so long and feeling like so tight with him that we are pretty much brothers. And another reason is probably, well, my dad had a twin brother that passed away that was really important to my family. So there's kind of a double meaning in that. But it's not just us two anymore. We do have a bass player as well that really brings the songs together more than they were before as a two-piece, I'd say. And we do have a lot of special guests from time to time. At our CD release show on May 24th at Club Garibaldi, we have a lap steel player that's featured on a couple songs, and also a viola player. So we do like to feature a lot of instruments. And on the album, there's a lot of different stuff going on.
You were an intern on Lake Effect. It seems to be a requirement these days to be a Lake Effect intern. And those that are Lake Effect interns, I don't know. I just get a lot of insight into the local music scene. So I want to ask you to share your insights for what you think the local scene is like. I mean, what music is accepted or popular, or is it difficult to get a recording contract? Is it difficult to actually find a studio to help you along? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, as far as making it big, getting a recording contract or whatever, I don't feel like that's tangible for myself. But I have seen some bands come out of Milwaukee recently that have actually been getting somewhere, which is exciting to me because I've been doing this here for about 7 or 8 years, and I haven't really seen much of that in the past. But Trapper Shep, another intern here,
yes,
open for the Wallflowers and is doing really cool things. And Field Report is actually getting somewhere, and they were opening on tour with the Counting Crows. No, but so they're doing stuff, and that's pretty cool. And there's some good music going on. But I feel the scene here is I'm not really sure how to describe it. I know that I don't really seem to fit in too well with any certain genre or scene here. It seems like for a while at least you had to pull out all the stops and do as many weird or different things as possible to get any attention. You know, the more instruments you can play at once, the better, you know. Keyboard in one hand, guitar in the other, yeah, while you're hitting a kick drum or something.
And ride a unicycle, perhaps.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. I try not to think about the rules and the categories, I guess, because it's just I don't really understand it, to be honest with you. So.
All right. An honest answer.
Great. Yeah.
All right. Maybe if you can just tell us a little bit about the creation process, how you go about, because the song you just did for us, was that a song specifically written as a solo song, or is it accompanied by your band in other forms? And then what we heard coming into this interview segment, and then we'll play another song of yours going out, are more full band songs. So is there a difference between those creation processes?
Typically, for me, no. I tend to write the songs on a guitar and the vocals just by myself, solo. So I feel like they all are... can work playing them by myself, and they tend to morph into something else when I bring them to the band members and see how they feel about the songs. The creation process is a lot different now that we're playing with more than two people in a band. There are more ideas going around. There's more – actually, it seems like a blank canvas when it was just me and Tyler, and we had these songs, and it's just guitar and drums. And almost anybody could have their own idea for where to go with it or what to do on it. So it's pretty interesting seeing what people do in the arrangements. Like we have a lot of string arrangements and some piano and things like that. It's definitely amazing sharing the creation of a song with other people. And I like that process a lot. But it all starts with guitar and vocals, just acoustic guitar and vocals. The one I played live here today was, I guess you could say it was meant to be solo. And it's solo on the album, but... we play it all together live. So who knows, really?
Well, Sean, thank you for coming back in. It was great to have you as an intern, and it's great to have you as a guest as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I had a great time.
Did I mention you are someone to know of? Cause I breathe easy knowing.
The album from Sean Rosch and his band, Twin Brother, is a self-titled work, and we're listening to a track from it called What I Am Speaking Of. Sean Rosch spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon just before the CD launch show in May. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.
What am I?